for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Melanie Gideon's midlife crisis seemed to begin when her husband announced his intention to buy a 4x4 van. Her reaction was not warm and embracing, and she could not help but notice his zest for new adventure compared to her own reluctance to take on new challenges. Now, in a new memoir, she details the pushes and pulls of midlife and her efforts to regain passion for life and an appreciation of its mystery. Her new book is titled The Slippery Slope, A Meditation on Living Happily Ever After. Melanie Gideon joins me in the studio, and we'll take your calls throughout the hour. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Melanie. Good to have you here.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
This idea of confronting a 4x4 van, what happened to you inside when you saw it?
Well, you know, my husband originally showed me a picture of the van.
I remember on
the website. And the picture that he showed me was not the actual van that he ended up buying. The van that he ended up buying, until he actually pulled it into our driveway, I had no idea of all the accoutrements that it was coming with. It was a 4x4 van it was tricked out, jacked up, diesel engine. I didn't know he had gotten a diesel engine, and I didn't know how loud diesel engines are when you're riding in a van like this. You can barely hear each other in the car. It was a monstrous behemoth, and it was so big it barely fit in our driveway. In fact, it was spilling out into the street.
So why do you think that that had such an impact on your soul, your thinking, your ideas about yourself and who you were?
Well, I think that I had been living kind of in a very small way, and just on a surface level, the enormity, the physicality of this van, and you could not ride in this van without drawing a lot of attention to yourself. And of course, he wanted my son and I to go camping with him, and he had all these ideas that we would go off and have these adventures. But whenever we were in the van, I just felt like everybody was looking at us all the time, because it was so obscenely large and noisy. And
I won't dare to ask what type of mileage it got.
No, I won't tell you. I won't tell you, though. It isn't as bad as you would imagine. It's not 5 miles to the gallon.
When you say that you felt you were living a small, compact, contained life, what did that make you think about your prospects, your outlook on life generally?
Well, I think what had happened to me is that I had become more of an observer in my life rather than a participant. And the reason the book is called The Slippery Year is that there's this phenomenon of slippage that I think can be very dangerous, because it doesn't happen quickly or abruptly. It happens slowly over many years. And in my case, I sort of slipped out of my life when I wasn't paying attention. And something happened with this van where it was a wake-up call for me, where I realized if I didn't do something to slip myself back in, I might have slipped out for good.
You know, I think back to those years when I was at home taking care of two young children and thinking about the rest of the world as really separate mm-hmm. from me,
yeah.
Thinking about my responsibilities within that home and not thinking about much else.
Mm-hmm.
So my world got smaller.
Yes.
How small was your world?
Well, yes, I think that was part of it. My son was, he was 9 when I started writing the book. And I think my world had also gotten small because I'm a writer, which is a problem. You do not want your world to become small when you're a writer. You need to be out in the world having experiences so you have something to write about. But at that point, I would drop my son off at preschool and I would come home. I would sit at my computer. I'd write for 3 or 4 or 5 hours. Then I would go pick him up and I would have very little contact with anybody except the other moms and dads who were dropping their kids off at preschool. That was my one, you know, interaction of the day, which I so looked forward to. But after I finished my third book, which was called Pucker, it was a novel for young adults, I just said to my husband, I just don't think I can write another book. I certainly can't write it with the kind of isolation I endured with Pucker. I can't do it anymore. So part of it was my vocation and that writing is a solitary profession. So that was part of it. And I think also, if I'm honest, I had gotten comfortable. I had stopped taking risks. I had stopped doing things like riding a bicycle because the place that I would ride a bicycle where I live is on Skyline Boulevard, which is this incredibly wonderful ride through the canyons in Northern California. But it's very scary because the cars are going past you 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And I wasn't brave enough to get on my bike.
I wouldn't be either, frankly.
Right. And I think part of that is also being a mother is I think instinctually I'm not willing to take the same risks physically I was when I was in my 20s and 30s.
Well, but that's the question. How much risk did you take when you were in your 20s?
I took 30s? a lot more, for sure. Yeah.
Like what?
Well, I was braver, I think, in every way. I was willing to try things that pushed me outside of my comfort zone. I was willing to try rock climbing. I was willing to try skiing, which I wasn't very good at, but I was willing to go back again and again and make smaller advances and have that be enough. But something happened, I think, in my early 40s where I just stopped even doing that. And I wanted more. I wanted to feel my life more deeply.
Tell me about your parents.
My parents, they live in Rhode Island, in Newport.
Your father
father is from India.
And your mother?
Here. My mother is Armenian.
I see.
And
that's a beautiful combination.
Thank you. And my father came here when he was 23, met my mom, I think, in Newport, if I'm remembering this correctly. He had come here to do his residency, and my mom was a nurse at the hospital.
Were they both risk takers in your mind?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, because when my parents met, I was born in 1963. I think my parents met in the late 50s. And my mom came from a very, Armenian family. And for her to marry my father was a very,
exactly.
very big deal. She broke all the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And was there perhaps some yearning on your part to have that same kind of boom risk-taking experience?
You mean earlier in my life?
Well, even later.
Well, I have to say, I have probably gone in the other direction. I think there was a spiritual yearning for that. And I think I have lived a very careful life. And for the most part, I have been afraid to take big risks. Not like my mom and dad. I think my dad coming here from India was probably a big risk and, something that took a lot of bravery on his part.
Do you think that the point you reached in life when you saw that blue van was simply a part of the aging process, the reaction that you had? Oh, my God. I can't deal with this. I can't ride in this huge thing. Everybody's looking at me, as opposed to the sort of quiet inner life you had had.
Yes. I think that it was for my husband. This was just for my husband, business as usual. This is the way he always lived his life, to the fullest.
And you married him.
I did marry him because I think I wanted some of that to rub off on me, you know, and it has. But I think he was just being himself. That was a very typical thing that he would buy a van like that. And
without consulting.
Oh, no, he consulted me.
And you said, fine.
I said, fine. But, you know, here's the other thing. I wasn't really paying that much attention. And then got this huge shock when he, you know, drove it up into our driveway. But
I have heard therapists say that we all marry that part of ourselves that's missing.
Mm.
So perhaps you sought him out for precisely that reason.
I think there's definitely some truth to that. Absolutely. And that has been difficult for us. And it's also, I think, why we're together.
Difficult how?
Well, because we're always clashing, because he's always pushing me, you know, to do things that I don't really want to do, but I know I should do, that will be good for me.
Do you think the slippery year that you had applies to many other people?
I do. I think all of us have slippery years. I think it's not even just a year. I think it could be a slippery minute. I think it could be a slippery week. I think it could be a slippery day. The way I define a slippery year is it's when you're in the process of transformation, you're midstream.
Melanie Gideon, her book is titled The Slippery Year, A Meditation on Happily Ever After. And welcome back to a conversation with Melanie Gideon. She's a writer. She grew up in Rhode Island. She has a degree in journalism from Emerson College. She has previously written a novel, but now what she calls a meditation on Happily Ever After. The book is titled The Slippery Year. You see, already people are saying they identify with you. And they're asking, we have a tweet from Gertie who says, any advice for someone who has never taken a big risk on how to start?
Well, in my case, I was kind of forced into it. But I think for me, after having written this book, what it's done for me is make me realize that if I don't take some risks, you know, a real essential part of me is going to wither away for good. And it's kind of like muscles that you don't use. You need to exercise that risk muscle if you're somebody who's kind of risk averse like I am. So, yeah, I think you just have to do it.
Just take that first step.
Yeah.
Here's another tweet. Is the van currently for sale, and might it force this sea change in my wife?
Oh, that's funny. The van is definitely not for sale.
I figured.
It is my husband's deepest love, I would say, besides his family, I hope. Absolutely not, but I can tell you where you can get one later on.
Read for us from the book, Melanie. and set this up for
us. Okay, well, this is just a little kind of fantasy riff of, before we moved to California, I live in Oakland, California now. We lived in Maine for many years. I love Maine. We go back there every summer. And my little sister, Sarah, still lives in Maine, and we always go to visit her. So this is just a little kind of fantasy riff on her life there. We are on our way to Maine for our annual summer vacation. Our first stop is Freeport. This is where my younger sister Sarah lives. It's also where I used to live right before we moved to California. In short, Sarah is living the life I thought I would have, but she's living it so much better than I ever could. With a huge backyard, a mosquito zapper, a kayak, three children, and the quaint Bow Street Market directly across the street from her house. Sarah really has the Maine life down. For instance, she takes full advantage of L.L. Bean, the flagship store of the Freeport outlets. When I was living in Maine, I did not know that you could have playdates there. I did not know that, in fact, playdates were encouraged. It made sense. Where else were you going to go during the 8 months of winter? Also, they have convenient mother's hours, as they are open 24 hours a day. Sarah might call one of her friends and say, "Hey, meet me at Bean's in tents and shelters at 5:34 a.m." Her friend might say, "We did tents and shelters yesterday. The kids are tented and sheltered out. How about gear and tackle?" Sarah might say, "Gear and tackle has an age requirement of 8. I can meet you on the stairs in front of the stuffed beaver or in the elevator. How about a playdate in the elevator?" Besides being family-friendly, L.L. Bean's also has the best return policy of any store in the world. You can even return stuff you never bought there. Sir, I'd like to return this pocket flashlight." "Certainly, madame. Were you not satisfied?" "No, I was not satisfied. My 3-year-old put it in a cereal bowl, poured milk over it, and sprinkled it with sugar, and it wouldn't work after that." "I'm sorry, madame. And when was this?" "This was, well, it must have been 1976. "Oh, welcome back, madame, welcome back. Very well, here is your money. We are giving it to you with adjustments made for inflation and 2008 pricing and emotional distress. That's $99.75. Would you like that in cash?" "I am very sorry the pocket flashlight did not live up to your expectations. And is this cute little tyke your grandson? Did you know we have a playdate program here?" "No, I would not come between 5 and 6 a.m. It gets very crowded, especially in tents and shelters." "What's the little tyke's name?" "Oh, a fine name. May I give you a tip? Do not bring little Achilles to archery. In fact, avoid scopes and rangefinders, too. May I suggest waterfowl?"
L.L. Bean must have been thrilled with that passage.
I know, but I love L.L. Bean.
I'm sure you do.
And they do have an amazing return policy.
But you know what I'm interested in? Why is that the life you thought you would live, and what happened?
Well, I guess this goes back to the question you asked me about taking risks. My husband and I had been living in Boston, and we had this fantasy that we might be back to the landers kind of people. We had this, this back to the land kind of fantasy. So we moved to Maine. And as it turned out, we really weren't back to the land kind of people. I think for me, my world was not big enough in Maine. I needed more of a writing community. I needed to be energized by the pulse of the city. That's what happened. It was 5 lovely years that we spent there, and I had my son there, and it was a wonderful place to be pregnant and to give birth to him and spend the first 2 years of his life. But we absolutely did the right thing when we moved to the Bay Area.
And yet, when you moved to the Bay Area, here you found yourself that much more isolated, alone,
mm-hmm.
writing.
Yes.
Inward.
Yes, still.
Mm-hmm. So it did not quite satisfy that risk-taking need on your part.
Right. But what it did, I think, was there was no way I could ignore the world that was out there anymore, because it was, I would open my door and there it would be. There would be the bikers. You know, hundreds of bikers streaming by me because they're in huge groups, packs, whatever, living their life to the fullest. There would be, San Francisco across the bay, this, you know, glimmering city, just a bridge away. So it was all there. It took me a couple of years to live my way into it and to figure out how to get into it. But I did.
And now, how do you feel?
I feel a little nervous, I have to say. I mean, I think that what's happening for me now is I am firmly in my life and taking all sorts of risks. And it's a little nerve-wracking, but very exciting. I think it's what I've always wanted. I still don't ride in the van unless I have to, unless forced to. But I am taking lots of other risks.
You know, it's interesting to me that you wrote in the book that you once told your husband you did not want a birthday cake.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were disappointed when he took you at your word.
Mm-hmm.
So in one sense, you wanted it one way, but you really wanted it another way.
Yeah, I think it was always, don't make a big deal, don't make a big deal, don't take up a lot of space, don't take up a lot of room, but then very disappointed if people took me at my word, because I think everybody wants to take up a little bit of space. You know, you want to be seen. You want to be known. You want to be loved, you know, by the people in your life.
Are you going through a phase in your life that certainly is producing the written word, but still struggling with finding your way through your own life?
Yeah, so let me just get back to what I think a slippery year is. I think it's when you're in the process of transformation, and it's like you've gotten a call to awaken. So the call has come. You have heard it. And I think there's no turning back. It's like you have one arm in the sleeve of your old life, but it doesn't really fit well anymore. The sleeves are too short, maybe the cuffs are frayed, and you've also got one arm in the sleeve of your new life, but you haven't quite grown into it yet. Those sleeves are too long. So you're in this in-between kind of liminal place. All you know is that change is coming, and you have agreed to it. You have agreed to it somewhere inside of you. Maybe not 100% yet, but you're on your way. That, to me, is the idea of a slippery year.
And the slippery year feels risky.
Definitely.
And scary.
Yes, you don't know what you're going to look like really on the other side. You know you're going to look and feel different, but you don't really have the picture of what your life is.
Do you have to push yourself through it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every day?
Yes, definitely. I think I'm still in a slippery year. I don't think my slippery year ended with the writing of this book.
I was wondering about that.
I feel as slippery as ever at the moment, I have to say.
What kind of relationship do you have with your sister?
I have three sisters. My twin sister?
Your twin sister.
My twin sister, Dawn. You know, Dawn and I are fraternal. We are not identical. So in some ways, you know, we never had that bond that I hear identical twins have. We were, I think, more like sisters. Very close, but we fought a lot.
She came first.
She came first, yes.
And you write in the book that you think as she was born, she pushed you out of the way.
Yes, yes. I was definitely the more submissive twin, without a doubt.
And yeah. She is more assertive.
Yes, she certainly was.
And quite comfortably assertive.
Yeah. You know, Dawn was, you know, we were very fierce when we were girls about having our separate friends and not allowing our friends to be friends with the other twin, because we each wanted to have our own, you know, our own life. But if I ever got in trouble, Dawn, who just was scrappy and a fighter and, you know, very athletic, she would just be there for me. She would absolutely be there for me. And as it was with all of my sisters, I think when it came down to it, we would, you know, fight to the death for one another if somebody was coming after us.
Where is Dawn now?
Dawn lives in Massachusetts.
So do you see her fairly often?
I don't. I see her once or twice a year when I come back to the East Coast, usually.
Is her ability to take risks far greater than yours?
I think it was, but we might be, you know, equal now at this point, I
really?
Would say. Yeah, I think so. I think I've come a long way. Yeah.
From those early days. When she was first out of the womb.
Right. Right. Yes, I think so. I think so. Yeah, but I think out of all my sisters, I was definitely the quietest, the most submissive. You know, I was always out in the woods with my notebook, writing stories or kind of living in my head a lot, living in these worlds I made up and reading, just reading voraciously. So I lived a very internal life. I had a very rich internal life.
I want to ask you about the column you wrote for mm-hmm. the New York Times. Was that the beginning?
I think it was the beginning. I've written fiction for years. My last two books were novels for young adults. I don't think I had ever written nonfiction really until the summer of 2007 when I wrote this little piece about my son going to camp for the first time. Then a couple months after that, I wrote this piece about my husband's van. And that was accepted in the New York Times for the Modern Love column, which runs in the Sunday Style section. And I think when that happened and I started getting this wonderful response to it, I knew that this was a voice that wasn't going to shut up, that it was time. It was time to let this voice out.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. All right, we're going to open the phones and go first to Diane in Wabash, Indiana. Good morning. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Certainly.
I was just going to say I do identify very much with this. Now, when I was young, I think I was a bit of a risk taker, and I married a man from India, in fact. Well, I noticed you were talking about that. But since then, all through married life, I think I've been quite cautious and passive. And after I retired, suddenly I had less responsibilities, and I had this moment when a friend asked me to take a ride on an ultralight airplane with him, and I never would have done this. It would have scared me to death. But I thought, hey, why not?
Why not?
Yeah, when will I ever do something like this if I don't start doing a few things now?
Yeah.
So in little ways, I think I've changed. And I've you know, been able to speak up more, assert myself more. And I actually went and got my ears pierced last week.
Good for you. That's terrific.
It's funny. It took me 66 years to do it.
So clearly the risk-taking doesn't stop once it begins.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think Carl Jung said the ages of 25 or I would say like 15 to 40 are really about establishing our ego, right? They're about figuring out who we are, what we want to do. Do we want to have a family? Do we want to get married? Do we want to have kids? What is our work? And then the second half in our 40s, maybe mid-40s on, is about then how do we make meaning? How do we make sense of our lives, examining our lives? And I think what happened for me at 43, 44, early 40s is it suddenly hit me that I had probably less time ahead of me than behind me. And if I wasn't going to take risks like going in ultralight, which I wouldn't do, fabulous for you, then when was I going to do it? You know, it's kind of, you know, it's now or never.
Well, Diane, how having your ears pierced, tell me what that's done for you.
Well, what happened, my daughter-in-law gave me a beautiful pair of earrings that I couldn't wear, of course, because I don't have pierced ears. And I just felt kind of liberated. I thought, well, I've been such a scaredy cat, I'll just go ahead and do it. Of course, now I'll probably have to change the type of metal because I'm having a little trouble. But
oh, I know exactly what you mean. I had my ears pierced years ago, and it wouldn't work. Kept changing from gold to sterling to platinum. Nothing worked. So they've closed up on me. But I took the same risk. Diane, thanks for calling. I do think that as we get older, we become either more or less confident depending on how we move ourselves.
Or maybe there's, I think that if we are open to seeing where we are, that there's sometimes this little kind of membrane place, which I call the slippery place or the slippery year, where we are given a choice, where we have an option to either move forward or kind of stay static.
Melanie Gideon, her book is titled The Slippery Year. We'll be back in just a moment to take more of your calls, your comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Join us each weekday on Fresh Air for conversations with writers, actors, and musicians, as well as interviews about stories in the news. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. We're talking with Melanie Gideon this morning. She's written two previous books for young adults, but now a meditation on Happily Ever After. Her book is titled The Slippery Year. And if you've just joined us, perhaps at some point again, she will describe what she means by that slippery year, a year of finding herself, looking within, and really not wanting to miss out on the wonders of life. 800-433-8850. Let's go to Frankfort, Michigan. Good morning, Camille. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always been a bit of a risk taker. I've done things, gone in the Peace Corps, and done a lot of traveling, and just sort of sought to answer whatever questions have come up in my life. But I'm curious about whether or not your guest has had any, say, difficulties or negative consequences of some of her new risk-taking, and if so, then what does she say to herself so she does not slip back into her old life?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm trying to think of what... I think that actually the writing of this book has been a big risk-taking adventure for me, I would say. I think after I finished the book, I realized that the book in some ways is my van. It's been kind of my vehicle, kind of willingness to expose myself. I think when you're writing fiction, it's a much safer route to go than writing about yourself and about your family. I will say that when I set out to write this book, I didn't want to write a book that that trashed my family or overexposed them in any way. I was very intentional about that. I wanted to write myself back into my life. I think I kind of have done that with all of my books in a way. If there's a personal journey for me, that's what happens. With each book that I write, the process for me is I do start paying attention because I'm just collecting information, and that awakens me. The negative consequences, I think, would be about feeling exposed, feeling vulnerable.
What has the reaction been from your family?
The reaction from my family has been very positive. From my husband and son, I didn't let them read the book until I was done, and then I just kind of crossed my fingers, and I think I handed the book to my husband, and I said, "This is a love story. You may not think that upon first read, but I think it will grow on you," and I think I can safely say he thinks that now. And I think it is. I read one review recently that described it as that, a kind of a love letter to life and to my family. So,
did you have any trouble finding a publisher?
Not with this book. I've been at this a long time. I am not an overnight success. This is my fourth book. My three previous books were with wonderful publishers, wonderful editors, but much smaller kind of in scope and in scale. I think that it was just time for this voice and time for this book. So when it came time for my agent to sell the book, it sold pretty quickly.
Good. And we should mention that Knopf is your publisher. Mm-hmm. My publisher as well. Here's an email from John, who says, "It's interesting to hear you talk about not taking risks personally, but I think as a society, we're taking fewer risks. It seems we're always trying to make things safer. For example, compare a playground now to one only 20 years ago. The long metal slide is now plastic and short. The swings are smaller. The monkey bars are lower. And the merry-go-rounds are going away. Mm-hmm. We might be getting safer, but we're sacrificing some fun."
Oh, I'm totally with you on that. I absolutely agree. It's funny, we were just on vacation for the past 2 weeks, and a big part of what we did was ride bikes everywhere, which we don't really do. I said that previously, because we don't really have a neighborhood where we live. It's we live on about 1,000 feet up, so unless you're willing to just be riding hills all the time, which I'm not, you really can't ride around our neighborhood. But here on vacation, we were in Maine. We were able to just ride bikes. And my son, I could just see the longing on his face for, "Why, you know, tell me again about the days when you were young and you could just take off on your bikes after, you know, dinner for hours and your parents didn't know where you were." And I can just see the longing on his face that these were the old days. These were the, you know. I'm really sad that we don't have that anymore.
Well, there are good reasons why we don't have all of that, but it does seem a shame as our...
But we didn't have that when we were growing up, and here we are.
Well, here we are.
We didn't really even have seatbelts, I think, for the first five, you know. I don't think I wore a seatbelt until...
I didn't wear a seatbelt until I was an adult. All right, let's go to Mike on Long Island. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning, how are you today?
Fine, thanks.
I just wanted to comment briefly. I think that her points are excellent, and what she's writing about are really important issues. And I'm 45 years old, and I've been an adventurous risk-taker my whole life. That's just the way I live my life. And I'm a volunteer fireman, and I climb mountains and scuba dive and do pretty much everything.
Aww. Mike, you should see
the look on my face.
You should see the look of longing on her face. Go ahead.
Yeah, I sound, and her husband, I can relate with the van. Although it may be loud and obnoxious, it gives you a pathway to another part of life that a lot of people don't get to experience, as far as getting you places to camp in wilderness areas and perhaps just opening up wonderful opportunities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's something I do, perhaps not with such a obnoxious vehicle, but I can understand if you're open to that, it could really give you a lot, because I find the balance of taking risks, like I rock climb a lot and things like that, but the balance is with taking risks cautiously, it gets you to perhaps a place to sit down and take in the grandeur of nature and just the beauty, and it then is a self-accomplishment, that wonderful feeling when they say that feeling of climbing a mountain. There's a reason for that saying.
Mike, you've said it all so eloquently and beautifully. Really does make you yearn to be that kind of outgoing person.
Yes, absolutely. And it makes me think about what the previous caller said, too, and I'll bring that into the conversation about if we don't give our children these experiences and also ourselves, where they are forced to really and we're forced to really push up against what is comfortable and have to coach ourselves through it and say, you know, you can do this. This is really scary, but you have to do this. You can do this. Mm. And then get to the other side. Then we are missing some essential, you know, building of character that we need to be building that character all through our lives, not just when we're kids.
Now, here's another point of view from Karen, who says, I echo Ms. Gideon's thoughts on losing your risk-taking tolerance when you have children. It's especially true once your children become teenagers. A mother's innate need to protect her children kicks into overdrive with teenagers. You wake up to find you have zero tolerance for risk-taking since you try to squelch risk-taking in the child just to keep them safe. Sometimes it feels like putting yourself into your own box and not finding a way out.
Yeah, I completely understand. I have a friend who just had a baby, and she said to me the experience, and I thought she said this so beautifully, was like suddenly she was wearing her heart outside of her body. I think once you have a child, you are wearing your heart outside of your body for the rest of your life. My husband and I used to ride, he has a motorcycle, and I used to ride in the back of his motorcycle.
Really?
Oh, I did love that, though. I loved that. But until somebody asked me, well, what would happen if you got in an accident?
Exactly.
You could both be gone. And this okay, so we still do go out once in a while. But, you know, I also wanted to say one more thing about, we're talking about risk, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of happiness, because that was something I was thinking about a lot in this book. And, you know, am I happy enough? Are we happy enough? Is this enough? Is our life enough? Is it good enough? And what I realized was that absorption actually equals happiness for me. When I am fully engaged in something and fully present, then I am happy, and that could be something as simple as sharing a bag of Twizzlers with my son, or it could be having to travel 500 miles in the van and, you know, sitting on some beautiful beach in Southern California, or it could just be the act of making dinner. But as long as I was really engaged and absorbed in what I was doing, then I was happy. There was happiness. That was it.
Are you happy now?
I am very happy now, yes. In this moment, yes.
Good. Let's go to Wichita, Kansas. Good morning, Charlie. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, ladies. I have two quick examples. Many years ago, a good friend of mine worked with the husband, and I worked with the wife, and they were young grandparents. And we went to their house for dinner one night, and we pulled up and said, well, somebody else has come to dinner. So we walked in, and I said to Ken, who owns the Bronco? And he says, Wanda. She traded in her Thunderbird without consulting me.
Oh, my goodness.
And Donna said, "You go, girl." And on the way home, Donna was, she was kind of mystified by the, I says, "Well, remember, this is the woman who at 19 in Spokane was dating a young Air Force officer who came to her one day and said, 'I'm being transferred. I'll never be back. Either you go with me now or we'll never see each other again.'" And she went.
She went.
Wow.
Good stories, Charlie. I appreciate your call. Let's go now to Sandra, who's in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning.
Good morning. Unlike most days when I listen to you from beginning to end, I only heard the second half of the show, but talking about risk, I started life as a rather conservative, quiet young female, married very young, and then later on met and fell in love with someone else. I took a great leap against anything I had thought of before. I divorced my husband. I married the second man, and he has been the love of my life until he died a couple of years ago.
Aww.
And I get things in the mail to this day that say he worshipped and adored you, and you had a beautiful love story. So I took the biggest gamble of all time, and he's still in my heart, and I live my life walking proudly because of that. And actually, I run a bereavement group helping other people through this. But I took a big, big risk.
You sure did, Sandra.
It paid off.
I'm so glad for your sake that it did. Though I must say, I think that is such a huge risk after, you know, a long marriage, too.
I think love is a risk. I think love is the biggest risk.
No question. At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning. And segueing from what's just been said, I recovered from breast cancer 7 years ago, and it really made me look at my life. And my big risk now is reconnecting with people who have been estranged in my life over the years, relatives and friends, and for whatever reason, maybe a family history or something of estrangement that I don't even know the reason sometimes, and just pulling myself together enough when you talked about character to decide that I want to reconnect with these people and that life is short and that, you know, that is what life is all about, is that love issue, that issue of connecting with people. And it is very scary and very risky, and I write letters and make phone calls and so on, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
But well, and that's the risk, isn't it, that sometimes it works, sometimes the connection is reestablished, and sometimes it doesn't.
Right, and the risk is being willing to fail, to feel really badly, to be disappointed, to disappoint somebody else.
Yeah, good point. And to finally, to Peter, who's in Coconut Grove, Florida. Okay, Peter, go ahead.
I may have misinterpreted the comment that the guest made, but I thought she said that she did not want a birth. You know, she told somebody she did not want a birthday cake, but then was angry because she didn't get one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's what happened, Peter. What's your comment?
Well, perhaps you should just say what you want.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Are you doing more of that now?
When I can figure out what it is that I want, absolutely.
Well, you know, there are times when I think we want our spouses or our dearest friends or our companions to read our minds.
Yes.
And it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. We have to say what we want if what we want is reasonable.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And you're learning to do more of that now.
Yeah, I'm taking up a little space, so I can say what I want.
And what's the reaction been when you say what you want?
Well, if I, sometimes the needs are met, sometimes they're not, but at least people know who I am. And, you know, I didn't want to go through life not having the people that I loved not know who I am. And so I would say that's changed.
Of course, there's one passage in here we didn't have time to read about your fainting.
Yes, about my fainting when my son was about to go to camp, to sleepaway camp for the first time. The night before he went, I fainted, which didn't really have anything to do with him going to camp, I don't think. It was the heat, but it's a funny episode.
Melanie Gideon, and her new book is titled The Slippery Year. It's a meditation on happily ever after. Congratulations. I hope the coming years are good for you.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.